Welcome to the Far Middle Podcast with Nick Deolius. That's yours truly speaking. I'll be your guide here through the next 30 minutes or so, a very interesting conversation. So we're sitting at episode 62. That number, I think, offers not just a worthy, but a pretty fun dedication to talk about. The dedication is going to go to Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors and his career high mark for points of 62 in a game. He achieved not that long ago, last year in early 2021, against the Trailblazers. And we make this dedication to Steph Curry's 62 points because, yeah, he is a phenomenal player, particularly for the modern game. He was basically built for the way the game is played today. Two-time league MVP, four titles. You get the feeling you don't want to write any of that in permanent ink because he's far from done with respect to what he's going to achieve for the rest of his career. And I think he's the greatest shooter in NBA history. Most people know he went to Davidson in college. And I don't know if most people know this little factoid about him during college, but Davidson wasn't his first choice, I'll put it that way. He really wanted to play for Virginia Tech. He wanted to be a Hokie. But the Hokies wouldn't offer him a full ride because of his smaller size, and they would only offer him a walk-on slot. Thus, he went over to and committed to Davidson. So maybe not the most astute move in collegiate basketball recruiting history by Virginia Tech. He ended up being the NCAA leading scorer in points per game for his junior year, which was the last year that he played at college. And when you look at Steph Curry and our dedication to episode 62 with his 62 points, his career high back in early 2021, maybe two items to discuss. One, let's talk about where Steph Curry ranks with respect to the all-time greats in NBA history. So as great as Steph Curry is, and he is great, he is not the greatest player ever in the history of the NBA. Some are making that argument, and you've heard more of that being advocated for when he just won his fourth title not long ago, but I just don't see it. I don't see him being at the top. In fact, I don't see any way he makes it to the top. I wouldn't put him personally in the top five. And my thinking on that, Michael Jordan, of course, he has to be first. You got to have Will Chamberlain in that top five. You got Bill Russell and Kareem. Take one of those two, whichever you prefer. And I haven't gotten to Magic Johnson yet. And really, at the current day, with the current day players, LeBron, he might actually be a better choice through his career, even though personally, I prefer Steph Curry over LeBron James. I like Steph Curry, like watching him much better than LeBron. But I will say, Steph Curry definitely in the top 10 of all-time great NBA players. I'd probably rank him in line with Kobe Bryant and maybe slightly higher than where I would put Larry Bird or Shaq, Tim Duncan, Oscar Robertson. Those would sort of be in my bottom half of my top 10, sort of numbers six through 10 in there. And then the second thing to talk about with respect to Steph Curry and this dedication, 62 points in a game. Okay, that is very impressive for sure. But then you start to put that in context. This gets back to like where Steph Curry ranks with respect to the all-time greats in the NBA. Guess how many times Will Chamberlain scored 62 points in a game? He did that six times. And, he scored 63 points twice. He scored 65 points three times. He scored 66 once, 67 four times he hit that mark. 68 he scored once, 70 once, 72 once. He did 73 points twice, and he did 78 points once. And oh yeah, he did hit 100 points one time in Hershey, Pennsylvania. So I took a lot of heat dedicating episode 13 way back with the Far Middle to Dan Marino. And when I look at these statistics with respect to Will Chamberlain and compare that to Steph Curry's 62 with his career high, maybe that criticism that I got for not dedicating episode 13 to Will Chamberlain, maybe some of that was deserved. But with title number four secured a few weeks ago and being the best shooter ever, 62's dedication to the career game points high of a hardcore great Steph Curry, it fits the bill, and that's what we're going with. So Steph Curry is the ultimate sniper shooter. And this brings us to the issues to start connecting with this episode. All that sniping, politically and unfortunately with actual sniping with firearms, involving and within the Ukraine that's going on today. There is the political sniping and statements, and then there is the actual reality. So let's talk about the reality for a key nation with respect to what's going on in Ukraine, like Germany. Now, Germany in late June enacted its second step in emergency measures to deal with a shortage of natural gas. And of course, natural gas is used to generate electricity and manufacture numerous products, feed agriculture, and heat homes during the winter. The reserves of natural gas in Germany, they are becoming frightfully low because Germany adopted energy policies that shuttered its domestic supplies of natural gas, that relied on wind and solar at scale, that have flopped and are late and suspect in reliability, and that also built massive pipes to fill the inevitable energy void the country would face with Russian natural gas. That's the now infamous Nord Stream pipes, the ones that our own government at first supported while our government was canceling things like the Keystone pipes and other domestic pipeline projects within the United States itself. So Russia, it invades Ukraine largely because it knows it's got nations like Germany by the short hairs on energy security. And now that Germany isn't falling in line, Russia is deciding to turn its gas supply down and may shut it off altogether with respect to the flow to Germany. Germany ends up with a shortage of natural gas going into winter, so it enacts in late June what it calls the alarm level. What does it do at the alarm level? Well, when you activate the alarm level, a key thing that you see in Germany is restarting coal plants, coal power plants all over the country to make up the power deficit from natural gas and to conserve natural gas. Not very sustainable or eco-warrior compatible, to say the least. And the next, by the way, and third step in this fiasco is going from alarm level to actually rationing natural gas, which may end up being the inevitable outcome when it's all said and done. Now, all of this happens because Germany and the EU and the West have consciously decided to embrace climate and energy policies that manufactured energy scarcity and that created or fabricated geopolitical instability and that catalyzed economic dysfunction. And it may end up getting worse, and some of that worsening we may experience in the United States as well. And this brings us to the next topic. So let's talk about how the balance of trade and the flow of energy in the form of BTUs and kilowatt hours and megajoules are all netting out in this turmoil of climate policy and energy policy and war and geopolitical game board. Think through the reactions and the consequences of all these stances and policies. First, you've got the US and the EU and the West adopting a code red for humanity ideology, whereby it justifies policies that demand bizarre or counterintuitive actions, like shuttering domestic energy in the EU and US, whether it be natural gas or oil. Then these same nations, they've embedded within these policies an all-out dash to wind and solar modes of power generation because of the academic theory or a government ministry spreadsheet saying that that's going to work wonderfully and instantly. But of course, the reality is that they, and here I'm speaking of wind and solar, they can struggle when you try to apply them on a massive scale. They are very costly. They need subsidy and market protection. And they are, by the laws of unpredictable nature, inherently unreliable. Depends on when the wind blows or when the sun is shining. And they are mined and made in places like China and Russia. Now, when the wind and solar at scale do not deliver or do not deliver as soon as they have been warranted to, these nations that bet on the mad dash to them, they're going to have to buy fossil fuels from places like Russia. That's things like the Nord Stream pipelines in action, because to not buy the carbon from places like Russia is going to mean that the lights go out and commerce stops in the nations that are suddenly short on energy. All of this drives up energy prices and inflation for the cost of wind and solar materials and minerals, which then helps Russia and China's economies and hurts the US, the EU, and Western economies. The cost escalation is a transfer of epically massive wealth payment with the currency going in the wrong direction. It's going from out of the pockets of the middle class in Republican democracies and into the coffers of communist and totalitarian states. And we're talking about trillions of dollars in magnitude. Then Russia takes stock of energy prices and its balance of trade and the newfound reliance of Western powers on its energy. And Russia feels emboldened financially and geopolitically and thus invades the Ukraine. Germany and the EU, they may bark and say that they'll stop buying Russian energy, but they can't do that right away, of course, because it's unable to make the energy balance work. The West, as usual, immediately protests with words, but then it slowly forgets. Russia has been an apt pupil and knows this behavior quite well. So then Russia, starts to slowly turn that natural gas valve that goes to the EU toward the closed position, and it reaches an agreement with China where China starts to buy all that Russian natural gas and oil. That's happening as we speak, which is why Germany is on alert when it comes to a pending energy emergency going into this winter. So then China then uses that Russian oil and natural gas to power its mining and its processing and its manufacturing facilities to make wind turbines and solar panels to sell to Germany, the EU, and the United States. Worse yet, this is all transacted at increasingly higher and higher prices because the West environmentalists and the left, they say all this energy turmoil will be fixed by doubling down on the root cause ailments of so-called renewables and the green transition. China's balance of trade, it ends up benefiting massively. So then China uses that balance of trade boost and its newfound geopolitical strength from its gift of energy leverage to build more aircraft carriers and fortress islands in the South China Sea. And their militarization has been growing more than Russia's when you compare them side by side. Russia and Ukraine, that's just an appetizer compared to what might be coming with an emboldened China when you look at Taiwan and all of Asia. So now the EU and Germany and the United States, we have less energy security from domestic oil and natural gas. We rely more heavily than ever on China for our energy security. We can't stop buying Russian energy, and we face epic, as in 40-year high, inflation and economic headwinds. The West is as weakened as ever when trying to stand firm against communism and totalitarianism, and its enemies, they've never been stronger. Now, what was the root cause of all this? And what got all of this rolling? It's climate and energy policies that did not think the basics through, and it didn't think the realities through. Or maybe the originators and the architects of those policies knew exactly what they were doing. So what's more frightening to you? Blindly ignorant buffoonery or coldly calculating ideologues when it comes to the leadership of the West these days? And that brings up really the next topic to discuss, because all this policy around climate and energy and all these new regulations and all these proposed SEC rules on climate risk that we discussed a few weeks back on the Far Middle and all the ESG investing complexity, cumulatively, these are creating a boom for elites and academia and bureaucrats, of course, and consultants. And more, consulting is becoming the bread and butter moneymaker for classic financial auditing firms. I see recently that a large global accounting firm is planning to split itself into two separate entities. And for those of you not familiar with these larger big accounting firms, there are three in particular that are the largest, and they do basically two things within their business. On one side, they audit the financials and internal controls of large companies, especially public corporations. But another side of their business is providing a wide array of consulting and advisory services. And this can range from everything to IT, to environmental, and anything else in between that you can imagine. Now, the problem increasingly has been that if you are an independent auditor, if you're an auditor, as these big three firms are, you have to be independent. That's in your name. So if you're wanting to be a consultant to a company or its management team, you can't also be asserting that you're an independent auditor that's going to do a good job keeping management honest on behalf of the owners or the shareholders and investors. It's a conflict. But the consulting and advisory services side of the business, you know, it's not just lucrative, it's starting to grow way past the revenue and opportunity that you get from traditional financial auditing work. So the decision of one of these big three was to potentially split the firm into two separate companies or two separate firms, one exclusively financial audit and one that's going to be exclusively consulting and advisory services. And the partners at the firm will enjoy quite a windfall if and when the split were to occur. Now, on the surface, you know, you see this, or I did, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with it. It's if it creates more value for the owners, in this case, the partners of the firm. So if that's going to be creating more value by splitting into two separate entities, so be it. That's the free market at work. That's capitalism in action. But, you know, something there was nibbling at me with bother, and I finally was able to pinpoint where my discomfort sat, and I wanted to share it on the Far Middle. And it's rooted in what is driving all the demand for the services that these firms are offering to public corporations, all this consulting work, because the root of the demand for the consulting services, it sits in more government regulations, in more bureaucracy, in more rules, in more risk, in more exposure. all of it cumulatively upping the cost of doing business for public companies across all sectors and industries, although some, particularly energy and finance, they're going to be hit harder than others. And that may be changing, by the way, as well, when one considers how sectors like tech are being subjected to the regulatory hammer and the administrative state onslaught as much as any these days. Now, there are beneficiaries of all this incremental bureaucracy and complexity. And who are the beneficiaries? Well, government and its countless bureaucrats, right? It's job security and more power, so it's doubly beneficial to them. Another beneficiary group are firms offering help to comply with all the new hoops, like these big three accounting firms that I just mentioned. So that's the expert class, so to speak. And not ironically, many of them quietly but continually press and lobby for more of these rules because they understand the benefits of their business model that's built off of regulation and complexity. And then another beneficiary group is going to be the large companies with market power because they've got scale and size that allows them not only to shoulder the extra cost and workload, but also push out smaller competitors, which gives the behemoths more market power, more control, and a bigger monopoly. So think of it this way. Think of banking. JP Morgan can comply with all the new complex regulations, but a small community bank that may end up one day rivaling JP Morgan, right, is pushed out of the space because the scale of the rules, it's too far, too wide, too heavy, and too vast. Now, the entities that lose in this type of business and regulatory environment, well, that's what's concerning. First, smaller and mid-sized upstarts, as I just mentioned, they can't shoulder the overhead, so they're losers in this overall netting of the outcome. Consumers are going to be losers because they pay for all this in the end through higher prices, and they're also going to have less choice due to less and larger players in the space or industry. And then taxpayers are going to be the losers because all these roles grow and bloat government to bigger and larger spend budgets. So when you think through those winners and losers, you sort of end up seeing the doers and value creators in a private sector free enterprise market coming out as the losers, and the bureaucrat and the value appropriator and the big business interests, they become the winners. It is one of the underlying themes of my book, of course, Precipice, which I hope you had a chance to order and read. Yeah, I suppose greed, when it comes to greed, auditors are as suspect to it as everybody else. Except, of course, which brings us to our next topic, the Pope, who is above it all, as at least he would have us believe. But Pope Francis, his track record is betraying a very different type of a truth, some leftist tendencies and sympathies that continue, unfortunately, to catalyze suffering across the globe. He's been at it for a couple months now since Russia invaded Ukraine, taking pains and going great extents to defend and cover for Russia and Putin. If you recall, in an interview he gave maybe 2 months ago now, the Pope suggested that Russia's invasion might have been encouraged by, using his phrase, the barking of NATO at Russia's door. And more recently, he followed that gem up with saying that the Ukraine invasion had no clear, again using his phrase, good guys and bad guys. It's sad to see that the current pawn of moral confusion and lack of clarity is applying on such a large life and death situation. That's very and particularly troublesome for Catholics to see, I might add. And why is this Pope closer to Pius XII and the shameful lack of action in World War II when dealing with Nazis and Mussolini than closer to the inspiration of John Paul II, who took on communism? I don't know. Is it because of his wanting to grow the business model of the church by merging with the Russian Orthodox Church, sort of a merger of equals, to use corporate merger and acquisition parlance, so to speak? So you end up making nice with the leader of Russia and its military aggression? Or does he not like the United States and the West because he has socialist leanings when he goes back to maybe when he grew up in Argentina? Or perhaps he is at odds with the United States because he viewed America as the lone superpower, and from the church's perspective, it desires to be the lone superpower for Catholics. In other words, the U.S. is a rival to the Catholic Church vying for ideological supremacy. Or maybe a little of all of the above is at play. Can't know for sure, but we do know what he is not doing is that it's what's in the best interests of Catholics. And what he's not doing is things that are consistent with basic fundamental Catholic doctrines, which of course involves stopping the aggression, the killing, and the war. And speaking of ethics and philosophy, I saw something recently I thought you'd get a chuckle from. It was a couple of slides where the titles were GoFundMe circa 1980. And the photos were a picture of who I assume was the creator of the slides when he was a teenager. One was him pushing a lawnmower, and the other one was him with a paper bag delivering newspapers on his paper route. And the message was humorous, but it was also, you know, had a serious aspect to it. Are young adults and teenagers these days soft? It got me thinking of that theme. Or are the opportunities for them to go fund themselves different and more limited today for a whole variety of reasons? A lot of them outside of the control of the young adult or the kid. Or maybe both are true. So if they want something, what do kids today expect? And where or who do they learn this from? So I like the concept of GoFundMe. It raises awareness. It helps bridge troubling times for people. It's innovative. But there is also something there that lurks as a danger if we don't watch it, which is whether in society we now have the expectations that others, be it government or taxpayers or other groups, have a duty to provide for me. That's a bad thing. The responsibility for you lies with you, and for me lies with me. You need to feel that pressure and toil in pursuit of your own self-interest, and you shouldn't toil on behalf of others' self-interest, and you should not expect or wait for others to take care of your self-interest. That's why I say selfishness can be a virtue in America, and altruism, it can be misappropriated and hijacked by entities like the left, whereby it becomes a weapon instead of an individual choice. And that does not mean one should not donate to causes or charities, but do it because you enjoy it and it furthers things that you're interested in. In other words, do it for self or selfish reasons. I've not seen studies or data on this, but I bet some of the most driven people out there, and who many assume to be selfish people, you know, self-obsessed, selfish people, some of the most selfish on the planet perhaps, I bet a lot of them are also the most charitable that you're going to find. And I bet their donations in the end stem not from altruism, but instead a self-interest in the cause or the issue at hand. Hey, this wouldn't be the far middle if we didn't from time to time take a moment to talk some new real estate and housing bubble news. Last episode, we targeted in on the Malibu market out there on the left coast. So why not shift attention this week to the East Coast and that bureaucratic heaven that is New York City? Now, New York City, that's the place where all of big government and the left is brought to bear over the course of years. That's been the petri dish where you can see what happens when that occurs. You know, where those endless regulations from rent control to housing development codes, they transpire to supposedly improve livability and affordability and access to affordable housing for the underserved demographics of the city. Well, I came across a story in the New York Post that summed up the debacle that is the cumulative policies and political ideologies applied in New York City when it comes to real estate and housing. There was an apartment unit that came up for rent in that trendy and increasingly chaotic East Greenwich Village neighborhood in Lower Manhattan. Now, the size of this spacious abode, 371 square feet. Not 3,710, but 371 square feet. That's not tiny, that's a closet. Actually, if you do some quick measuring, it's more like the size of a single car garage. And not shockingly, it's a one bedroom. Now, on the third floor also of a walk-up, I might add, so you've got steps. And the rent that it was asking was a bargain at over $2,300 per month, and that's reflecting the benefit of it being a rent-stabilized unit. So note we don't call this rent controls anymore. That's too accurate. So we use a better sounding rent stabilized unit or apartment. Now, what people outside of New York City see as a joke, New Yorkers see as a huge bargain. That's because the average rents in Manhattan are now sitting at over $4,000 per month for the first time ever. So when this heaven of a 371 square foot apartment had a showing, the line snaked all the way down the flights of stairs and into the street. Now, if you do the math, the annual rent for this garage of an apartment is over $27,000 a year. The finance pros, they tell us, don't spend more than 30% of your income on rent, which means the only people that should be considering this 371 square foot pad are those that are making at least $90,000 a year. And it can't be a couple, right, with two incomes because there is not enough room for two people to cohabitate in this apartment. And by the way, the average salary of a New Yorker is under $70,000. so most New Yorkers can't even afford this closet of an apartment. Yes, I love New York. Welcome to the new urban utopia where the left makes the rules, it sets the regs, and it makes sure we all are equal, equally miserable. I wonder, and we all should worry, how long it takes for this nirvana to reach all of us, not just the unfortunate renters in Manhattan, because the left has gone, in the words of ZZ Top, nationwide. Let's close out episode 62. Let's do so by wishing a late July happy birthday to one of my all-time favorite writers, Ernest Hemingway. And I'm just going to give you a couple of his key quotes or writings from some of his key pieces of literature. I'm going to start with, "The only thing that could spoil a day was people, and if you could keep from making engagements, each day had no limits." That's from A Movable Feast. It just shows you that Hemingway was an introvert and somewhat suspect with regard to social interaction. How about this one from the classic Old Man and the Sea? "Every day is a new day. It's better to be lucky, but I would rather be exact. Then when luck comes, you are ready." A little bit of philosophy from Ernest Hemingway. And then this comes from my all-time favorite Hemingway book, For Whom the Bell Tolls. "I wonder if you keep on learning, or if there is only a certain amount each man can understand. I thought I knew so many things that I know nothing of. I wish there was more time." That about sums it up, doesn't it? Don't we all share that wish in the end that there was more time? And then, of course, last but not least, maybe the single best line in the history of literature, definitely the single best line from Hemingway, "Isn't it pretty to think so?" That was from the last line of The Sun Also Rises. To sum up basically the lost generation of the Roaring Twenties, that line was to take the fantasy and then make it square with the reality. The overall theme of that line and the underlying meaning of it, very apropos in 2022, just like it was around 100 years ago. And it's time to realize that what we have often been sold by the elites and those in power, as pretty as it sounds or as is advertised, it's not squaring with reality and how the world demands that things work. So farewell for this week, constant listeners, and talk to you soon.